Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. Hello, and thank you for listening. This is Mike Consell, your host. In the spotlight is Jay Newman, a former hedge fund portfolio manager who spent 40 years involved with international finance with a primary focus on managing investments in sovereign debt, including the distressed sovereign debt of Latin America, Eastern European, African, and Asian countries. He is viewed as the mastermind behind the historic 15-year fight to recover billions of dollars in defaulted debt from the government of Argentina. That campaign, which included the court-approved seizure of an Argentinian Navy ship in Ghana with 200 people aboard in 2012, reached a successful conclusion in 2016. The Wall Street Journal reported that the settlement was worth $2.4 billion, a gain of roughly 10 to 15 times the original investment. The New York Times reported that the refund was 392% of the original value of the bonds. The Financial Times said the settlement is, quote, seen as one of the greatest hedge fund trades in history, all of which has fed seamlessly into the man's debut novel about dark money in global politics. The title is Under Money. It was published by Scribner Books in January as the first installment of a three-book contract. Under Money has been described by none other than star novelist Nelson DeMille as a groundbreaking, unconventional, and wildly entertaining peek behind the curtain of American politics, financial skullduggery, and high-stakes global conflict. Author Lee Child of Jack Reacher fame called Under Money essential reading that makes your heart beat faster like a thriller should, but also teaches you something big. Jay Newman, congrats on the book deal and welcome to the program.
Mike, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, your timing is so good because this novel just feels so well-timed when you think in terms of the swelling numbers of the ultra-rich around the world, Russian oligarchs, cryptocurrencies, the Panama Papers, widespread tax evasion, governmental corruption, personal greed on a titanic scale that we see around the world, and the even the wholesale use of sanctions against renegade regimes. I mean, right now, with Putin's invasion of Ukraine, that's very much a financial saga on really a scale we've never seen before. I don't know if we've ever seen sanctions imposed in such a comprehensive way in so many countries participating. So that power of money, the frailty of the human psyche, I don't think has ever been more evident. What do you say?
Mike, I agree with you. I don't think we've ever seen economic warfare waged in quite this way. Sanctions have been imposed throughout history. But I think for the first time, the range and scope of these economic weapons is, you know, in full force. And to have 57 countries, you know, join that program is unprecedented. I mean, during just before World War II, the U.S. effectively sanctioned Japan by cutting off some of its oil, and then, you know, immediately after that, restricted, essentially seized Japanese assets in the U.S., which made it impossible for Japan to buy, you know, to pay for any oil. So we've seen sanctions and we've seen the effect of sanctions, but I agree, this is the first time on this scale. And it's, frankly, it's scary.
Scary in what way?
Well, it's scary because I think there are a lot of unintended consequences to economic warfare. And one point I wanted to make is when I use the term economic warfare, it's not to credit Vladimir Putin unduly, but he called it economic warfare. And I don't think there's any question that that's what we're engaged in. It's we're engaged in an undeclared war, you know, on the part of, you know, the cohort that are sanctioning Russia against Russia, because the goal, and it's been quite effective to devalue the ruble and to attempt to crush the Russian economy, has been quite effective, at least in the short term. We'll see what the medium term and long term effects are. But we're at war. And I think it's important to understand that, because when you're at war, your enemy feels justified in taking a lot of actions they wouldn't otherwise. And I think that's what's scary to me.
Throughout your career as a, as a master of the universe, let's say, Tom Wolfe had anything to say about it, you've seen all the dark money, how money is used, the slush funds and so on. But along the way, after decades of doing that kind of work, you got the impulse to write. When did that impulse first strike? Is this something that goes back many years, or was it very recent that you decided that, hey, with what I know that's going on in the world, what I've seen, what I've been a part of, that can actually best be told through fiction rather than trying to write a nonfiction book on the topic?
That was exactly the impetus. I'd never written anything long form in my life. I'd written op-eds here and there on topics related to projects I was working on. But when I retired from full-time hedge fund work, I thought about, people encouraged me to write about my experiences, Argentine saga, our campaign against the Republic of Congo. Those sparked people's imagination. But I started to work on something related to that as a kind of a memoir, but I realized that it wasn't going to attract enough interest, enough attention. Who would read it except my family and maybe a couple of friends? So that's when I thought I could use fiction to really tell a bigger story. And that's why I turned to fiction.
And we were just talking about Vladimir Putin. He actually makes a cameo in the book, as does, I don't know if you'd call it a cameo, but Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia is in the book. So you have real life characters, real world characters in this book. And you know, writing a novel is probably much harder and more time consuming than negotiating an investment deal or selecting a fruitful asset class for an investment portfolio. Is it not? And talk a little bit about, because I've read, I haven't read the whole book, Jay, but I've read excerpts. It just released in January. And your writing is I understand why the publishing company is excited about this book. The writing is excellent, and it's engaging and it's dramatic. Did you always have kind of this skill for writing, or is this something that that you kind of worked at and just developed very, very readily in a short time frame?
Well, no, it was Mike, it was probably the hardest thing I've ever done to write this book. I essentially rewrote it four times. I wrote the initial draft, and I was showing it to friends and family, and they said that looks pretty fun and interesting. So I finished a first draft, and then through a friend, I was introduced to Sloan Harris at ICM, which is a literary agency. And Sloan took me on. The reason I was excited, because I don't know if you know the Red Sparrow books by Jason Matthews, but Sloan,
I don't.
Sloan had been the agent for Jason Matthews, Red Sparrow, the Red Sparrow series. Sloan took me on, and which is kind of, as I look back at that the draft that I sent him, I kind of can't believe he had that much faith in me, because it was such a meandering, weak, unstructured piece of writing. But under his guidance, I rewrote it once, and then he said, okay, we're now ready to go look for an editor. And he took it to Colin Harrison, who's the editor-in-chief of Scribner, which in fact had published Jason Matthews as well. So I kind of right out of the box, but I would say a year into my process, I had this dream team of agent and editor. And then the really hard work began, because I rewrote the book, two more times, under Colin's guidance. And then, after submitting it to Scribner's, It was just too long. And Colin insisted that, encouraged me to cut it by a third, which I did. So it's kind of a long, long story, and it's a long book, but it was a lot longer when it started.
How difficult was it to take a third of the book away? I mean, did you find that as you were doing that, this thing became leaner and faster and you liked the result, or was it painful to take, you know, my God, 33% away?
it was very painful. There were a lot of things that, I've saved them. So maybe I can redeploy them in another form. But as you say, it's leaner, it's faster. There's kind of a saying, I forget how it goes exactly, that you shouldn't fall in love with your own words, because there are always other ways to say things, say it better and more succinctly. And that's what the result was. I wanted to mention that how I got started, because it was, it started with a seed. A friend of mine, Don Carmel, who is actually the model for Don Carter, who's one of the protagonists in the book, had been a colleague of mine at Morgan Stanley in the early 90s. And Don had been in the military. He loved the Army. He came to Wall Street to make some money, which he did, and then went back into the Army. And It was his career that I followed over many years, his special forces activity and his secret missions, at least what he could tell me and then what I could imagine about them, that influenced me. And so I started with that one idea of what would my friend Don do if he didn't like the way the country was going, if he didn't like the divisiveness, if he didn't like the waste. And what would he do to change the world? And that was really the kernel of the entire book.
Wow. Now, did your publisher have any issue with Vladimir Putin and Mohammed bin Salman making cameos in the book? Did they feel like that made it a more immediate and recognizable and realistic read?
They didn't have trouble with either Putin or MBS. They did have a problem with some other characters. One of the characters in the book, and you mentioned the Putin cameo, he appears with a character named Fyodor Volk. And Fyodor Volk is actually was modeled on Dmitry Utkin, who is in the news these days. He's the head of the Wagner Group, which is a private military company, a mercenary company that that Putin uses in many theaters. So I changed that name to Fyodor Volk. I changed the name of the private military company in the book from Wagner Group to Parsifal. The origin of Wagner is that Utkin is an admirer of Hitler. We've read this. We're reading this in the papers as we speak. Mm-hmm. And Wagner, being a favorite composer of Hitler, he adopted Wagner as the name of his company. So I changed it to Parsifal, one of Wagner's most famous works. So the Parsifal group is the entity in the book that's run by this fellow Volk.
And Putin's about to deploy the Wagner group in part anyway in Ukraine is what we're reading right now, correct, Jay?
As far as I can tell, they're active in Ukraine.
These are mercenaries.
They're mercenaries. They've worked for Putin in Crimea, in Georgia, in Syria, most notably in Syria, and now in Ukraine.
I heard you interviewed talking about about epigenetics and the epigenetics of money and power. I'd never heard of epigenetics before. I had to look it up. But for our listeners' edification, talk about that. What is the epigenetics of money and power?
So the epigenetics are basically environmental factors that change your DNA, and it can either change your DNA or simply change how your mind functions. And there's a lot of psychological. I use a lot of psychological theories and work, not in an academic sense, but in a kind of a social and a critical sense in the book. And one of the things that I've experienced in watching people around me, and I hope that I'm not a victim of this, I'll claim not to be if accused, is the effect that money has on the brain and on people's behavior. And I think that in my career, I've seen people make a lot of money very quickly, and all of a sudden they move from being thoughtful and receptive to ideas and willing to engage to being convinced of their own infallibility, and that's really, I think, what's happened a lot in our culture, as we've seen this unbelievable accumulation and concentration of wealth in the hands of very few people, who suddenly decide that it's not just about the money, but about they should use their money and the power, the political power that their money can buy them, to influence events. I think we saw this in Russia in the case of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was an animal at the trough. He was a creature of Russian post-Yeltsin society, and made a huge amount of money owning and running Yukos. And then he decided that he was going to take on Putin, and ended up serving 10 years in prison because of that mistake.
Mm. Yeah. You know, as did, who am I thinking of? Abramovich, I think his name is. He's another one who ran afoul of Vladimir Putin. He was being interviewed and was basically saying all power, all your riches and power come from Putin. He wants you to know that, because if you cross him, he will come up with some trumped up charge like you're corrupt, you were committing acts of tax evasion against the Russian people, and it's time for you to go to jail. And then somebody else who's more loyal to him might be the guy who takes that over. Which is really not news, because it's been widely reported, especially since this Ukraine invasion has been underway. Let me ask you, though, about with epigenetics, you see that, what you're talking about, but you also see nowadays, certainly in the United States and probably other places in the world, where people are really fixated on the ultra rich, are fixated on accumulating wealth that they want to give away. There's this commitment that I'm going to give all my wealth away for good causes by the end of my life. A few million bucks to the children, the rest of it goes to the causes that I believe in, most of which are humanitarian causes, not necessarily trying to change governments. So you see that as well. What's your thoughts on that? Just that people do respond differently to money and power. But as they say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, is the old saying, I think, from what's the movie I'm thinking of? It's about the Hearst family, about William Randolph Hearst, with Rosebud. One I'm talking about. It's escaping me right now. But Citizen Kane.
Orson Welles, yeah.
Yeah, Citizen Kane. Yes, exactly. Orson Welles, Citizen Kane. What about that, though? Nowadays, you see a lot of rich people, ultra rich people, doing really good things with their money as well.
I think that's I don't mean to say that every time anyone makes any money, they go crazy. I don't think that's the case at all. And I think you make a very good point that most people who've accumulated large amounts of money realize they can do a lot of good in their lives and after they're dead by donating to charitable causes. But I think we also see billionaires on the, standing in the heavens, hurling lightning bolts of money at politicians. And about the political and the political establishment, and really trying to influence, policy both at a high level and at a granular level. And I think it's a phenomenon that we've not seen before in terms of the amounts of money. I've stopped giving money to, and I used to give plenty of money to politicians, thinking that it will make a difference. I no longer think it makes a difference, because I think at the amounts of money being spent by very few people are so vast that, you know, someone making small contributions is not going to make a difference. I think that's a terrible, I feel terrible saying that, but that's what I've come to believe. Because there was a great article in the New York Times maybe a month ago, 6 weeks ago, that talked about dark money donated to ostensibly charitable causes. So people getting 501c3 donations, and the Times identified $1.2 billion of money in going into left leaning causes, and roughly $1 billion going into right leaning causes. And they said this is just the tip of the iceberg, but in terms of dark money and under money and large amounts of it, it's flowing. And unfortunately, I think it's flowing, you know, in a way that supports extremism. So I think that for whatever reason, you know, large amounts are flowing not to the center, not the idea of creating a sense of the American people as a centrist society, which we are, but flowing to the right and to the left and exacerbating tensions.
You know, I see that too, although I would also argue, I'm curious whether this has been your, you know, assessment as well, because of the communications revolution, social media, in with widespread ability to communicate among everybody, although that's caused a lot of problems, including, you know, amplification of propaganda and misinformation and so on. It also seems that money doesn't win political elections the way it used to, that as soon as you start to take money from somebody who's got titanic wealth, it just, you're there, that politician is suddenly tarred with the idea that he or she takes money from so-and-so who is associated with such-and-such. And it can do a lot to damage a political effort as well. Maybe that's why so much of the money has gone dark, so that there isn't the opportunity to actually identify the source of the money and start to disparage that politician, start knocking him or her down to size, if we don't know where that money's coming from, which is really a scary prospect because it could be coming from overseas. I mean, Vladimir Putin, among others, as well, is well identified as somebody who, well, Marine Le Pen in France, he loaned her money from a Russian bank so that she, and she's been very favorable towards him. It's only been recent since he invaded Ukraine that she said anything critical. There's a lot of suspicion that Russian money, the oligarchs have laundered money through, and I don't want to get overly political. We're talking politics here, but, and I've never belonged to the Republican or Democratic Party. I've never belonged to either one of those parties. I never will. But the Trump family has profited tremendously from Russian money pouring in to New York City, buying condominiums, super expensive condominiums, and so on. And lo and behold, Donald Trump will be critical of Russia, but he never uses the name Putin when being critical. It's very interesting. We know who is buttering our bread.
Mike, I think you've nailed it when you mentioned the idea that it's people have figured out that it's better to go dark with your money than to go public, because you can donate almost unlimited amounts to these charitable, air quote, charitable organizations that are focused on issues. And it's really the issue. So you're right. Rather than be tarred with, you know, money coming from this guy or that gal, whoever, these charitable organizations can focus on issues and not on the individual. But of course, it's the same thing. So if you're, you know, in a district that cares about whatever the issue is, you focus on that issue and you use that to subtly denigrate your candidate's opponents and to focus the electorate on those issues as issues. So I think the darkness has is only getting deeper and darker, if you will. Because it's a safer place to be for both the political candidate and for the donor. I think donors don't like the idea of being, they want to have the influence, but they don't want to be targeted with having exercised the power. So the dark money, and of course, in our system, free speech and the right to speak freely, which is the right to spend your money, the Citizens United, rulings mean that on both ends of the spectrum, you find massive amounts being spent and now secretly. And this is actually one of the themes in Undermoney, which is that there are many, many ways in which money flows that are invisible. But it's always moving. Money acquires power, power begets money. It's a vicious circle.
And you said circle, and that's exactly what really it is. It's a circle of money. There are people who give money to each other. Those people then do things, especially in the political arena, that amplify that person's ability to make more wealth, and the money comes back around, and it's this whole circle of money that escalates. And on the one hand, we very much revere the super rich, especially those who clearly have done it through brilliance and innovation, somebody like a Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. Although now Elon Musk, even some people are getting suspicious right now. He appears to be poised to, he's just moved into a position where he bought a 9% stake in Twitter. They say his ambition is going to be to take that over, or at least get into a position of influence to where they start having to do what he says. And he's not a man without opinions, or a man who isn't interested in directing events. And that doesn't necessarily mean for bad, but as you were saying, the epigenetics of money and power, we all think of ourselves as good people normally and think that we're essentially incorruptible. And then the money lands in our hands or the power lands in our seat. And suddenly we're doing things that we probably never dreamed we'd be doing.
Well, people end up doing, we do things that are complicated. And you mentioned, a number of people that I admire greatly, including Elon Musk. I mean, that man is absolutely extraordinary. Without expressing a view on Twitter, because I don't know what his thinking is, the one thing that he did as part of a way to help Ukraine is to make his Starlink terminals available.
Yes.
But if you think about what he's done there, you know, he's taken SpaceX and he's basically helped to resupply a belligerent in a wartime setting. I'm not critical of the goal and the spirit behind it, but that's a very complicated position for someone to put a public company in. But that's to your point. It's Elon Musk, as an example, is a remarkable person who has perhaps decided that the scale of his ambition can be even greater than creating a series of completely amazing technologies and companies.
Yeah, he is an amazing guy when you think about it. I when I was a kid, was very much into the space program. When I was very young, I wanted to be an astronaut like a lot of young boys do. And I was at the moon launch. My father took us to the moon launch. And the idea that today we've got individuals who've got back then it was unfathomable to think that an individual could run a space company, could be sending rockets into space. Today we've got, for a lot of reasons, including the tremendous wealth that some people accumulate, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, they have space companies, Richard Branson also, and they're not the only ones. So they're able to do things that were really unthinkable for the individual in the past. And also they can do it in a way that's a lot more efficient than government. I mean, when you stop and think, let's think about the Human Genome Project. The government was going to spend its $1 billion unraveling the human genome. And I forget his name now, but the biotech industry executive who said the government is just pissing around with this thing. They're taking too long. And he decided, I'm going to go ahead and decode the genome. And he did it faster than the government did it. And I think at a lower cost. Today, if you want your genome decoded, it's, I think it's like $1,000 or right. $2,000. It used to be what, millions of dollars to get it done.
Yep. And you can, and you know, eventually as more and more people get their genomes decoded, we'll basically have a map of humanity, and we'll find out how closely we're all related to each other. The broader point you just made, which is one that I love to explore with you, is the role of government and the size of government. Because I think that it's for me, I would call myself a libertarian of sorts. I think there is a role for government, but I think that there are very few activities that government does better than the private sector. Very, very few. You wonder if, I don't know if your experience at going to motor vehicles, but, you know, for years going to the motor vehicle.
Not good.
Exactly. Now, why is issuing licenses and car registrations being done by the government?
Yeah.
I mean,
why is it being done even in person when we have electronic means to do this simply and efficiently? But I realize that you do need to show up. In some cases, they want you to pass an eye test and so on. But go ahead. Your point could be read right out of Reason Magazine, the magazine in the Reason Foundation, which promotes privatization of all kinds of industries, and this being one of them. Go ahead with your point, though, Jay.
Well, there's very little that But I think that the seemingly inexorable growth of government is, and this goes back to the nexus of political power and money, the ability to be perceived to be doing favors for people and doing things for your constituents is ingrained in this circular flow of money and power that involves getting politicians elected. I'm going to say something that is. Maybe it's not even that controversial, but politicians are kind of a special breed. And I think it's really unfortunate that we've ended up with a professional political class where people get elected and then they'll do anything to get reelected. Anything meaning they'll curry favor with donors and they'll do favor for donors because that's what they do, rather than doing something else with their lives. Why? How did we get to this point where, you know, we've got people who are in office for, you know, 3, 6, 10, 20, 30 years? Is that good? I don't think that's good for our democracy. I think we need some more diversity of opinion and blood.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree. And on the one hand, you want institutional knowledge. You want people, and we've had some great senators over the years, like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, or John McCain. Although I had issues with both, of course, because they in some cases, when you're running for office, a lot of times you make compromises that are kind of ugly. And it's kind of like you don't really believe that. I know you don't believe it. Why are you saying it? Sort of situation, but clearly they become entrenched. And they're not even paid all that much money. They could do a lot better in the private sector, but the power and the kissing of the ring is something that obviously becomes intoxicating. And with gerrymandering, we get more and more of these people who are,
I think,
working with a constituency that is not middle America. That is not. I mean, it's a virulent strain of the human psyche.
No, and I think you've hit again on this this notion of epigenetics, the idea that being in a position of power in which people come to kiss the ring, as you say, all the time, asking you for favors and talking to you like you're the font of wisdom. I think it gets very confusing for elected officials and. As you say, intoxicating. They can't imagine giving that up voluntarily. And typically they don't. I mean, the goal of most politicians is to remain politicians and to climb the rungs of political power. So if you started the school board and then the town board and then the, county legislature, and then maybe go to Congress and maybe you want to be a senator. It just keeps, you're climbing that ladder, And pretty soon, that is your career, and you lose track of what it means to be a person, you know, in the private sector, working at a career or a job. And you rapidly, I think, lose touch. And that's, I think, where we are, because I think most of our politicians today are professional politicians. You know, I don't believe that's a good place to be.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't either. I would like to see a system where they have the longevity, where their experience and knowledge provides good things and continuity in government. But on the other hand, it's a 10, 12 year run, let's say. And or even the Supreme Court, they're talking about term limits now, because we have people staying in there for political reasons and even dying in their seats, which is kind of crazy. And this even extends down to nonprofit organizations. Take a group like Zero Population Growth, which is a good organization working to stem population growth. But we know, based on demographics, that population is going to peak. In the not too distant future, it's going to begin declining. It's declining in a lot of countries already. And when that does happen, and it happens on a global scale, is this group going to say, mission accomplished, we will now disband? No, because once you're there, it's no like way. These are jobs. It takes on a life of its own. It's like a living organism. It has a survival instinct. So it's going to continue to talk, and it will exaggerate the dangers of the population that we've got, because that's all part and parcel of survival. I mean, we could go on and on about this, Jay, but I'd like for you to read an excerpt from your book. Can you, so that our listeners can kind of get a sense of the content and the tone. Do you have a couple minutes you can read from the book?
Yes, and I've got it right here. So the section actually that I have in mind is a chapter that takes place in St. Petersburg. And it's
St. Petersburg, Russia.
And it's where it's the chapter, as you mentioned earlier, where Vladimir Putin makes a cameo appearance. And I'll just read that. It's not not terribly long. There was a knock at the door, and Volk opened it to find Yuri standing stiffly, looking like Yuri never looked, uncertain and what? Afraid. You're wanted in the lobby. The words tumbled from Yuri's mouth. Sorry, sir. Now. Volk grabbed a light blue cashmere V-neck sweater and a down jacket and followed Yuri into the wide hotel corridor, empty but for a matched pair of extremely fit 30-something men. Buzz cuts, pigtail earpieces, dark blue suits, white shirts, black ties. They flanked his doorway. He knew the type, because he had a few hundred on the Parsifal payroll. More important, he recognized their lapel pins. Presidential Security Service. He held out his arms, and they gave him a desultory frisk. Not their usual rough handling. Someone must have told them to keep it light. Two more SBP officers held the elevator doors and brusquely motioned Yuri back as they ushered Volk inside. Moments later, the doors opened on an empty and eerily quiet lobby. Two men in khakis, open-neck shirts, sat at the low table drinking espressos. There was the butler, with his full head of silver-gray hair combed straight back, looking as well turned out as ever. The other was extremely fit, ramrod straight, blonde hair, watery blue eyes, stiff, but somehow also relaxed, not big, not small, not friendly, but not. Volk had once heard an old KGB general described Vladimir Putin as a perfectly ordinary man who resembled no one else you had ever met. But even so, face to face with his nation's most powerful leader since Joseph Stalin, Volk felt a shiver down his spine. What lies would they tell him? What truths? Russians have made such a fine art of lying that it isn't just a matter of whether we lie to each other, but how we lie. There were lies to make you feel better. Vranyo. Not outright deception, Boris Pasternak had written. More of an embellishment. And then the lies that politicians utter every time they open their mouths, because the exercise of power requires deceit. Lots. Those are the lies that do real harm, create injustice, cause mayhem, lies intended to deceive, to disable, to destroy. and there was the vast gray area between the two. As Volk approached, the butler wrapped a bony arm around his shoulders, and Putin extended a hand, giving him his signature look, direct, flinty, with that slight tightening of the corners of his lips that passed for a smile. Fyodor Repinovich Volk. Volk stood a little straighter and bowed slightly from his shoulders. Let's walk. The butler gave Volk's arm a gentle squeeze, like a proud father sending the boy off to war. Putin led Volk out of the lobby onto the corner of St. Isaac's Square. Volk looked around in amazement. He had seen some strange sights in his life, but the only times he had ever seen an entire city emptied of its people had been in war zones. So this is what it's like, Volk thought, to be quite plausibly the richest man on earth, with single-handed control over a more or less modern industrialized nation. It meant being able to make tens of thousands of people simply disappear. People like my parents, who might otherwise be out for dinner or strolling through a park, just so he could walk freely. What kind of disordered personality, Volk wondered, feeds on disrupting lives, commerce, and industry like this, subduing people who offered no threat and whose presence wouldn't have inconvenienced him at all, just because he could.
Well, that is the truth, isn't it? Because I've seen his motorcade one time, they showed it on television, and they just empty the streets. There's empty the streets, empty the buildings. And I would say that Putin is a classic case of epigenetics. Would you not? The corruption of money and power. He started off as just a KGB agent. He was in East Germany. He was almost murdered there when the Berlin Wall was falling. He lied about men with guns being behind the door. If they had called his bluff, he wouldn't be in power today. And
I think you're exactly right. Worked. And now he's emptying not just, Russian cities so he can walk around by himself. He's emptying cities in Ukraine and destroying them. It's just as you say, it's a perfect example of someone whose wealth and power have affected his mind.
I want to read, if I may, another excerpt from the book, just the first paragraph of chapter 32. It's headlined The Carlyle, New York City. The reason I want to read this is because let me read it and then I'll say what I think to our listeners, what I think it's indicative of. So it reads like this. The Carlyle hovered over Madison Avenue like an Art Deco dragon ready to unfurl its massive wings to protect its brood. For nearly 100 years, the world's elite had nested in its hotel suites and apartments. Only at the Carlyle could Michael Jackson, Steve Jobs, and Princess Diana have randomly shared the same elevator. Jackie, Caroline, and John called the Carlyle home after Jack was assassinated. Before that, the Robert Warren of tunnels beneath the building allowed Jack to sneak Marilyn Monroe and his parade of paramours into the family apartment, while the rest of the clan cracked lobster shells in Hyannis Port. That's the first paragraph, and that sounds so Wolfian to me. Tom Wolfe, who wrote Bonfire of the Vanities, and I'm sure that Scribner must be thinking in terms of under money is an opportunity. Now, Tom Wolfe was so famous before he wrote it, and to equal that would be asking far too much from a first-time author. But nonetheless, you obviously your money, power. New York, St. Petersburg, and so on, is the kind of thing people really gravitate to. We love power. We love the intrigue and so on. So beautifully written. And I wanted to ask if you've got two more books coming. This is a 3-book deal. Have you doped out the other two? Do you already know just basically, is that part of the deal that they asked you to do is go ahead and outline the next two, at least in brief, so that we know what this progression is going to look like?
Well, I know what this question about kind of writing and process. For Under Money, I had no idea, where it was going to end or even what was going to happen. For the sequel, the immediate sequel, which is entitled Uncertainty. I've got a complete outline, and I've started to write chapters based on the outline. The story arc. So very different process as a kind of a novice writer trying to be more systematic and efficient. But the story arc, the story arc of Undermoney is about this group of people who seek to get one of their their member elected to higher office so they can change the world. And it's about the choices they make and the and their morality and the slippery slope of ends justifying means. Without being a spoiler, when they do get their guy into a position of influence, the trouble really starts. And that starts really in the second book. And the uncertainty that I'm talking about is what would happen if you had an American president who was really, really willing and had the ability, because he's got a cohort of people around him who can execute events for him and make things happen, really, really willing to take on the domestic political establishment and also take on China. So those are the themes that I want to explore in the sequel. And I have to say, I mean, it's... it doesn't end well. I think that having someone in a position to exercise that kind of power, working at odds with someone like Xi Jinping, who has the ability to execute to exercise that kind of power in a country as big as China, having that kind of a clash gets really ugly really quickly. And while I haven't mapped out the third book yet, the working title for that is Unthinkable, which is what happens in the aftermath of that meeting of wills. So that's kind of where I'm headed with. And obviously, the events of recent weeks involving Russia and also the relationship between China and Russia. And the relationship between the U.S. and China and Russia are all things that I'm having to adjust for, let's say, as we speak, including the possibility that there is no Vladimir Putin when the dust settles over the Ukraine.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of people who are already saying, he's a dead man walking, that he certainly isn't going to wield the same power he has in the past, because the patina has disappeared. The Russian army is an incompetent bunch. They do have nuclear weapons, though, and chemical weapons, and they're willing to do World War II style bombing of cities, complete destruction of cities. It's going to take decades to build these cities back, and not to mention the human toll of it all. It's just dreadful. Let me ask you, though, that here you are, Jay. You're sitting down to negotiate with the publishing company. They probably rarely sit across from a guy like you who has spent his lifetime negotiating deals. They want a 3-book deal. Was there any hesitation at all on your part to sign a 3-book deal, maybe figuring the first book, let's say the first book is a smash, you want a richer deal for books 2 and 3, or did you negotiate? And I don't know whether you feel comfortable talking about this or not, but I'll put it out there. Didn't you negotiate some kind of sweeteners or escalators into the contract so that, look, if the first one exceeds expectation, becomes a real smash, I want a bigger share of the pie come book 2 and 3?
We're still working on the details of books 2 and 3 in terms of contractual relationship, but there's no question that I want to continue working with Colin and with Scribner's. I think the economics of books kind of are what they are, and it's not really that contentious. So I would say it's all quite friendly and very positive. So that's been a terrific relationship, and Scribner has been extraordinarily supportive. What I am focused on at the moment, again through my agent, Sloan Harris, is talking to media people about the idea of turning the book into a either a movie, which is not my preference, or a TV series, which is my preference, because I think it would give me an opportunity to develop these characters further and see them come to life, which would be kind of amazing. So that's the kind of world that, you know, I'm hoping to enter over the next, you know, few months.
Yeah, what a difference it makes that we now have Netflix and Prime and so on that do these series, because, you know, we've seen over and over again where a book is turned into a movie. Bonfire of the Vanities is a great example. Here was a landmark book, a spectacular read. They make a movie that was widely talked about as one of the worst book to movie efforts in history, in cinematic history. But anytime you're trying to cram a book into an hour and a half or 2 hour movie, it's almost sure to fail. But given a series and multiple seasons, perhaps, you can actually, as you say, develop the characters. You can tell the full story. You can do it over time. And that's pretty exciting. What is going to be, when readers read your book, Under Money, besides having an entertaining read and learning more about the financial dealings around the world, is there any other takeaway? I mean, you've certainly shed a lot of light on that already, Jay, but anything else you'd add that when people are done reading the book, hopefully they will take this or that away, or what your expectations as to what they might learn or take away?
Well, I hope that Under Money, first I want to mention something about Under Money, because Under Money is a word that I would like to take credit for introducing the word Under Money into the English language.
And a coinage.
Because it actually arose, it's Japanese slang. The way the term, I learned of the term, was that one of my sons had been in Japan and he became friendly with a Japanese restaurateur. And the restaurateur came to visit us in New York. We took him out to dinner and was thinking about opening a restaurant. And I asked him through my son David's translation, is there a difference between opening a restaurant in Tokyo and in New York? And he looked at us and he smiled, and then he shook his head no. He rubbed his fingers together in the universal sign of money, and he shoved them under the table. And he said, Under Money. Under Money originated as Japanese slang. In fact, there's a definition of it at the very beginning, in the frontispiece of the book. But Under Money is an idea and a concept, and it's the way the world is actually organized. And what I'm hoping people will think Under Money whenever they look at anything they don't understand. I'm hoping that when you open the paper and you say, gee, what's going on there? Why are they, whoever they are, doing that? If there's something you don't understand, the answer is usually Under Money. It's some flow of cash and power and relationships that influence people and events. And so what I'm hoping, and this is incredibly grandiose, right? So maybe my brain has been epigenetically affected by, by money or writing or something. And, you know, I'm just as bad as the next guy. But I'm hoping that the term Under Money becomes part of the vernacular. And people are thinking Under Money all the time, because Under Money is actually flowing and working all the time.
Jay, it happens all the time, just in terms of these coinages. Actually, it's rare, but I mean, it's not unprecedented. Catch 22, title of a book, we use that phrase all the time. There's also Multiverse came from the Snow Crash, a novel by Neal Stephenson. Mm-hmm. And that list goes on and on. So there's nothing necessarily that grandiose about it. But of course, entering new terms in the language is no small feat. And Under Money might just be the next one. Again, our guest has been Jay Newman, former hedge fund portfolio manager and involved in international finance globally and at the highest levels. He is the author of Under Money, the first of a 3-book series, and hopefully we'll be seeing it on Netflix or some other streaming channel as well, as efforts in the works anyway to see that through. Jay, thank you very much for taking the time and joining us.
Mike, I can't thank you enough. It's really been a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.